Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege and a pleasure to welcome back to the Salier Report, the Saker. We're doing our quarterly discussion of the emerging multipolar world. Today we're focused on the Ukraine, Russia, and the lobbyists of war is what I'm calling it. So, Saker, thank you again for joining us. You've got a new piece out this morning. Maybe we could just dive in and you tell us a little bit about it and how to find it on your website.
Yes, good morning, Catherine. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Three of us actually signed a collective warning because we're all three Russian bloggers in the United States. So it's Dmitry Orlov, which you probably know through the Orlov Club. Then there's Eugene Gurevich, who is the head of the Russian version of the Saker blog, and myself. And we're basically trying to raise the alarm because we believe that if nothing is done, there is a high risk of war between the United States and Russia. And we also believe, which is, I think, highly relevant, is that that war, even if it starts locally in Europe, would rapidly escalate into a nuclear war. We don't believe it can stay confined to Europe, and the United States, the U.S. mainland, would be hit. And so we're trying to, and finally, we also believe there's no reason for that, that this is purely ideological, that Russia has been cornered, essentially, into a position where she cannot retreat any further. Because we think that over the past 20 years now, the West has been pushing Russia further and further and further. And now, American weapon systems are literally within artillery range of St. Petersburg, and there is U.S. and NATO forces deployed all around Russia, literally in Europe. And we believe that if that continues, if nothing is done to change that course, the chances of war and nuclear war and intercontinental war that even would affect the U.S. homelands are actually very high. And we're extremely worried about that. So we try to raise the alarm.
Okay. Well, let's step back and then build back up to how things have gotten this bad. Bring us up to date on what's going on in the Ukraine.
Well, the Ukraine, it's more of the same but worse, but then it's true that it has been going on like that for a while now. I mean, clearly the major development now is that the Central Power is getting weaker and weaker and weaker, which allows more extremist people to become in position of key positions. Poroshenko is still holding on to the central authority in Kiev, I would say exclusively thanks to U.S. support. I believe that if it wasn't for the support of the United States, he would probably be overthrown by now. And what is very worrisome is that the people who are trying to take action against him are really true neo-Nazis. I mean, what happened basically is that, to make a long story short, I think the revolution, the first revolution, and the Maidan was, some people say, the revolution of the millionaires against the billionaires. So, the millionaires overthrew the billionaires and took power. And I would say the bulk of the very top of the junta in power in Kiev are very wealthy individuals.
Right.
Usually they're referred to as the oligarchs. However, there's another group which is very distinct from them, which are the neo-Nazis, the real extremist people. And when I say neo-Nazi, I don't mean that as a slur. I mean they're every bit as ideologically focused and passionate as any member of the NSDAP or the SS would be. Another example, just to give a correct understanding, we're not talking about nationalists who just wave flags and sing songs. I would compare them to Daesh in the Middle East in terms of their ideology and the kind of methods they're willing to use. And now we're seeing a man like Andriy Paruby, who is now the second man in power. I mean, he's the speaker of the Ukrainian Rada. And probably most of our listeners have witnessed the return of Nadezhda Savchenko to Kiev from Russia, where she was on. She had been convicted for the murder of two journalists. She was pardoned by Putin on the demand of the families, who wanted two Russians arrested in Ukraine to be exchanged for her. And when she came back, I mean, I posted on my blog both her initial speech when she landed at the airport, and then yesterday she spoke in front of the Ukrainian parliament. Wow. I mean, these people are the real thing. I mean, they're not oligarchs. These are truly, ideological purists of their ideology, and they put a great deal of they are a direct threat to Poroshenko. I mean, the latest what I heard, and I cannot confirm that 100%, but I'm pretty sure it's true, that one of the volunteer battalions, that's the polite word for death squads, called the Aidar Battalion, actually said that if Poroshenko signs the Minsk II agreement, or he signed them already, if he actually implements them, that is, if he gives the status of autonomy to the eastern Ukraine, they would actually hang him. Now, you have to realize that in a country like the Ukraine, we're very, very much dealing in the situation of a failed state. The local authorities, the regional governors, the various death squad commanders, all are loyal to the center to the degree that the center can provide either money or protection. And now the center can't provide either. I mean, money-wise, they're running out of it. The West is funding just the minimal needed, but it's not enough to pay off all the local warlords and oligarchs and gang, heads, etc. And in terms of protection, there is no real, a state is supposed to have the monopoly of violence. Well, the instrument of violence that you would say legitimate in the Ukraine, such as the police, the military, practically, for all practical purposes, cease to exist. They exist on paper. But in terms of the real firepower, they're all in the death squads and the volunteer battalions and the Nazis. So the Ukraine is slowly sinking into a Somalia-like kind of failed state. But the appearance is saved because as long as Poroshenko is in power, as long as officially they can meet with Western leaders and they can hug, etc., it looks okay. Well, it's not. Nadezhda Savchenko, when she came back to the Rada, the first thing she said, she addressed the members of parliament that are sitting there, which she certainly considers as fat cats and cowards that she has no respect for. And she said, "I will never allow you to sit in these chairs and forget all the people who died for our cause." I mean, that was a threat. So I think that Ukraine is slowly falling into complete chaos. The big question is, will they? One of the questions is, would the central authorities try to still attack yet again, a third time now, the eastern Ukraine, with the hope of, do what the Argentinians did with the Malvinas War, try to distract from internal problems by creating an external conflict. But that is the big question. I mean, on one hand, they might do it out of despair. On the other, all the signs are that the Donetsk and Luhansk republics are way stronger militarily, and at the end of the day, they are backed by Russia, so they're not going to succeed. So it's chaos, it's internal violence, and it's the different factions of those who came to power in the Maidan Revolution are going after each other. That's how I would summarize the situation.
Right. So you're going to have steady depopulation because people are going to keep immigrating elsewhere.
Oh, that's already happening. Yes,
Right, and the
definitely.
economy is just going to keep going down, down, down. At some point, don't pieces collapse into Russia?
No, not necessarily, because I think pieces do collapse. I mean, the key word here is pieces. What happens is, in a situation like this, the local authorities, and I lose that term very loosely, become far more relevant. That is, what I see much more happening is people in the various regions basically more or less openly ignoring Kiev and starting to do their own thing because they're better off doing it. Really, they are. So you would have the Western Ukraine, Ivano-Frankivsk, Lvov, doing their own thing. The South, Odessa, and all these, the Black Coast region doing its own thing, and the East basically doing their own thing. And the center is the big question because they don't have a natural, a position there. But what I see is a regionalization. Again, not unlike what happened in Somalia, actually, where local warlords controlled certain sections of the country, and that's where they will now become local potentates who will be able to provide protection and money. Because money will still be made during a situation of war, when an economy collapses, there is still a lot of money to be made. It's just made differently, and it's concentrated in different hands.
Right, especially if some of the farming continues. I mean, it's
The
really a
farming,
question of.
there's much more. There still is a lot of things that can be done. I mean, there's trafficking is one big thing. The southern Ukraine has always had a very distinguished tradition of doing that under every ruler, and it's sort of a natural, which is really sad. It's ironic because what's, the what the people in southern Ukraine, particularly the city of Odessa, did by doing constant, you know, black markets, marketeering and trafficking is really what the Ukraine should have done openly and legally, which has become a hub between East and West. And that would be have been really the natural calling for the Ukraine, to be a neutral, a separator between, you know, East and West, and a natural, obvious, you know, commerce and transfer of goods and services kind of place. And that is what's going to happen in the South. They will still do it. They'll just do it illegally.
So how does this, how does what is happening in the Ukraine relate to the U.S.-Russian relationship?
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to answer your question directly. I went to a tangent here about the pieces falling back to Russia. Why I don't think this is going to happen is because Russia has the ability and the desire to accept a large number of refugees, but she has the ability to close the border to chaos. So
right.
It's not like there's no risk of infection in terms of, I mean, there is a risk, but I think Russia can cope with it, which is not the case, I believe, of most of Europe. They will deal with the worst of the refugees. Russia has a very effectively functioning internal security service, the FSB. They have large border troops. They actually created a National Guard recently. All this are actually exactly the tools needed to sort of build not a physical wall, unlike what the Ukrainians did with the, you know, for a while they had a project of building a moat along the Russian-Ukrainian border. Nothing came of that. Millions of dollars were stolen over that. That's all that happened. But an administrative wall can be built by Russia to protect herself. But Europe is the big question, because you we saw already with the wave of refugees from the Middle East that Europe is completely unable to cope with that kind of phenomenon. That's what I wanted to say about the pieces falling back to Russia. As for the Russian-U.S. relationship, well, what concerns me is that the U.S. will use that chaos to the max to create a non-existing Russian threat. Because basically, you know, irrespective of reality and facts, all of that will be blamed on Russia. No matter how ludicrous that is,
right?
You know, it's
right.
The old trick. It's the famous weapons of mass destruction, and you know that Saddam had, or the Serbian fighters who can fly, I believe, in like 45 minutes or something. Oh, 45 minutes would be the time needed for the Iraqis to strike the UK. And then I remember when the war started in Bosnia, the Prime Minister of the UK was saying that the Serbian MiGs could fly and bomb London. I mean, that kind of nonsense. I think that's what they're going to do to try to instill a sense of panic and fear, because the United States desperately needs a crisis in Europe. And that is desperately what Russia does not need. So I think that's going to be the next major, major geopolitical process, is the determined attempts by the United States to create a crisis at all costs in Europe, and Russia trying as hard as she can to not get involved in it.
But if the U.S. accuses or tries to blame all of it on Russia, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. In other words, if they're just trying to smear Russia, why does that have to... Russia's remarkably able to stay immune to phony accusations.
Okay, well, there are two main scenarios which both could happen. The least toxic one is the following one. The idea to create a crisis is to not only push, basically it's about big money in that case. By creating a sense of tension and panic, and in Latvia, they're already doing pre-invasion drills because they're expected, you know, the Russian Ivans to come on the tanks. So that's how other... the population, the local politician that tried to scare the population. I heard yesterday a report that actually most Latvians don't believe that Russia wants to invade, but the same deal is going on, exactly the same thing with Poland. The government in power there is constantly trying to ward off a Russian threat. So what that means is bigger military budgets. That's very, very simple. All the Eastern, and Professor Stephen Cohen has been listing the figures in his during his recent appearance. The figures for the budget for the military spending are going dramatically up.
Right.
And since NATO countries have to be compatible with NATO standards, that means basically getting American equipment. So that's the first big thing. It's a lot of money. It's a multi-billion dollar business, which is going to help the U.S. military-industrial complex. The second thing that this provides is career opportunities. I mean, it's not irrelevant. If you can make a name for yourself by making loud statements inside NATO, now being a hardliner also is a career-enhancing thing to do. Just as in Poland, you know, they're competing to see who can be most Russophobic, because that then in the White House is seen as career-enhancing. So that's why you have people, you know, like Grybauskaitė, for instance, in Lithuania, who makes insane statements, and we have the Poles doing the same thing. So that's another thing. It's a political way of getting things done. And finally, the more the reality of a putative Russian threat is, you know, mentioned, that justifies NATO. And if you draw it out long enough, you know, it means NATO is going to be present in Europe for another 50 years, and that means that Europe will remain a U.S. colony with no foreign policy, no independent policy at all. That's just going to be, you know, a protectorate of the United States. So that's, that actually is the good scenario. The much scarier one is the idea that some people in the United States would like to start a local war in Europe just to, you know, get the same objectives, but, you know, with a maximal premium on it. That actually, and also, since a war in Europe would further weaken the EU economies, that would actually have a side effect of strengthening comparatively the dollar and the U.S. economy. So that is the more scary thing. Either they're trying to just create attention, but not cross the line. They think they can stop on time, or they actually want a war in Europe, but they want it to be limited and contained. And myself and the signatories of that appeal, which we call the Russian Warning, you can find it on my blog at thesacred.is. We don't believe that a war in Europe would be confined to Europe only, because of modern equipment and the ways modern wars are fought. So that's the really scary thing, that somebody in industry wants actually a shooting war with Russia.
Right. So this is starting a war with somebody who's got intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, you know, I've spent many, many years trying to understand what the deep-seated hatred of Russia is. I used to have a relative who was in the U.S. military, and he would go off about how, you know, whether it took 100 years or not, we had to get the Russians. And I would get him to try and explain why that was the case, and I could never get a coherent explanation. So let me just run some things by you. Right now, if you look, one of the biggest industries in the United States is, as you said, weapon sales and exporting military of a variety of ways. It's a huge business. And we're the number one in the world. Russia's number two. In many respects, they're the only one who can take us on in terms of development, creation, and marketing of weaponry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder if some of this isn't just a pissing contest over weapons market share. And that extends into space. You know, if you look at who has the most technical knowledge about space, it's the Russians. I mean, they were the first to get a satellite up, and they've managed to maintain, and Putin's managed to revive a lot of that capacity. And that gets me back to the importance of space weaponry, something that nobody talks about, and it's impossible to get really good information on. But one of my big questions keeps being with respect to the U.S. dollar and the reserve currency is ultimately what it's backed up by, space weaponry. And of course, we don't admit to really having much in the way of space weaponry. It's a very sort of, ungoverned area and dynamic area, but Russia has the potential to really threaten us on it. So two things in my mind is the competition for weapon sales, and sort of supremacy in space. What other reasons are there? Where's this very deep-seated hatred coming from?
Well, that is a topic that really would deserve a PhD thesis. As a matter of fact, a Swiss journalist and a member of the Parliament of the City of Geneva, his name is Guy in English, Mettan, M-E-T-T-A-N, just released a book in French, and I know it's coming out in Russian. I hope it will be coming out in English. It's called Russie-Occident, une guerre de mille ans, which means Russia, the West, a thousand-year war. And the subtitle is Russophobia from Charlemagne to the Ukrainian Crisis. Because the roots are really extremely old. I would fully endorse right. the theory that the West has hated Russia pretty much for the past millennium. It began by a religious hatred that soon became a political one. My contention is, and I know it's a very controversial one, that the West has always had a messianic ideology underlying its own self-identity. Additionally, it used to be the papacy who felt, you know, that the Pope is the, I think it's in English, it's vicary. I mean, if you want, the deputy of Christ on earth. I'm not sure of the name in English. I'm sorry. You know, that he basically rules the church in the name of Christ all over the planet and all the Christians. And if the Christians, like the Orthodox, don't obey, then they need to be subdued. Then other ideologies came. After the French Revolution, it was the Masonic revolutionary ideologies. They again identified Russia as being the one that resists and doesn't allow things to go the proper way. Of course, we had the episode with Hitler, which had his own racial ideology. Then came the democracy and capitalism ideology. All those ideologies lay a claim to universalism, and Russia is the big, you know, party pooper. It's a country who, first of all, doesn't accept any of these ideologies. Secondly, has actually the military means and the population and the resources to confront and fight them. So I think the roots are very, very old. There is a Russophobia which takes its roots, you know, at least 1,000 years ago. But it's not only that. There is more. There is a much more recent Russophobia, which is the one of the neocons. Now, their Russophobia is a very unique phenomenon because what they basically come from, ideologically, and very often their families, most of them have roots in Trotskyism. So these were the people, I would really say, created the Soviet Union. Trotsky certainly was ideologically, I personally consider him the most brilliant person among the Bolsheviks, but next to Lenin probably. But he created the Red Army. He installed the Bolsheviks into power, won the civil war against the whites, and then basically the Trotskyists ruled until Stalin came to power. When Stalin eventually seized mm-hmm. power, he purged that entire element. And I think that created a fantastic deal of resentment on the part of already pretty anti-Russian. Trotskyists were always, you know, very anti-Russian. Most of them, the vast majority of them, were Jews that considered that Russia was an anti-Semitic country. And here again, you know, they identified that as a Russian anti-Semitism. Never mind that Stalin was Georgian, couldn't even speak Russian with the proper Russian pronunciation. So they, a lot of them fled, came abroad, created the basis of leftist movements, first Trotskyite movements in the West, which then eventually flipped into from the extreme left to the quote-unquote extreme right. I don't think these categories really mean much, but that's how they're used today. So we have the neocons, who are now the hardliners for the empire and for supposedly conservative values, who come from, you know, former Trotskyites, and they have a personal hatred towards Russia, just as they hate the Palestinians because they dare to occupy their quote-unquote Israel.
Right, so let me bring in money for a second, because
okay, sure.
We know that the U.S. Treasury teamed up with the Russian mafia during the 90s to kind of asset strip Russia, but, you know, basically from 89 to 97, 98, mm-hmm. Leading to the Russian bankruptcy, which is why Russia enjoys not having a whole lot of debt right now. Anyway, the Russian mafia is essentially 99% Jewish.
Yes.
And my question is, how much of that money is really the money financing the neocons?
I doubt it. I really doubt it. Maybe I'm mistaken. I'm not a mafia specialist. And I would say, when we say that the Russian mafia is 99% Jewish, I think we're talking about the original Soviet / mafia during the democracy years in Russia under Yeltsin. There is definitely a non-Jewish Russia mafia too. Mostly in Russia. And then the two, as far as I know, work very nicely together. No problem. No racial tension between them. But I just think that the
it's
kind
all business.
But yes, all business, exactly. But I have never heard of, as far as I know, the neocons. I've never heard of any, information linking the neocons directly to Russian mobsters of any. I mean, unless you consider Khodorkovsky a Russian mobster, which he was, of course.
Well, it would. But yeah, it would flow. It would.
Does
flow
he really need
Wall
to
Street.
Finance? Who is financing? You know, is Khodorkovsky financing Soros or Soros Khodorkovsky? I think it's the other way around. I'm not sure, though. I might be mistaken.
Right. Well, it would flow through Wall Street, so it certainly wouldn't look like Russian mafia money.
Yeah. My understanding is the neocons, what I observed is that they managed to successfully infiltrate first the Republican Party and then the Democratic Party, and they did that inside the United States by their own resources. I'm not aware of external involvement. But then again, you know, the fact that I don't know something doesn't prove anything, so maybe it happened. Right. I don't know.
Well, one of the interesting things that I've seen about the neocons, to the extent I was exposed to them during the Bush administration, is they really believe in chaos. They really believe that the way to clean the slate is to, you know, basically bring chaos and wreck the place, and somehow then magically your new order is going to emerge from that. And, you know, it's kind of a insanity that they just never seem to give up on.
Yes, but is that really a new kind of specific thing? I think all people driven by ideology of hate are much better at destroying than at building.
Right.
I think it's for people who are driven by hate, and the neocons certainly are, building is just not sexy. But to destroy really well, that's interesting. I mean, that's what they do naturally. I don't think they're very good at building anything. What have the Trotskyists or the neocons ever built positive? I'm unaware of anything.
Right. Leonard Cohen has a line that I love. He says, "We were blinded by the beauty of our weapons." And that reminds me of the neocons.
Absolutely.
Well, let's dive into Russia, because one of the things that's amazed me, I've watched many different people, companies, countries cave in the face of enormous pressure by the U.S. and things like financial sanctions. And what's been quite remarkable is, all those tactics seem to have boomeranged and worked the other way in Russia. The Russian population seems to support Putin in standing up to the sanctions and fighting back and creating independence in a way that you would never see happen in the United States. So it's quite remarkable to watch what's happening.
Yes, and it's due to a couple of factors. The first thing is, remember that the Russians are very close to the Ukraine. So they're seeing what's happening right across the border. And they also have, most of them at least, a vivid recollection of the, if not late 80s, certainly early 90s and the 90s. So they have been shell-shocked. A lot of, for instance, I recently was listening to a very interesting Russian analyst on the Russian radio saying, you know, the argument was presented by Westerner that if we accept all the West conditions, we'll live in prosperity and we'll be left in peace. And he retorted to this, the guy who, that I'm quoting is called Sergei Mikheyev. He retorted, but we've already done that. We've caved to everything. We sold everything. We completely bowed to the empire. We did everything that we were asked for in the 90s, and look what that got us.
Right.
So, and that is really crucial to understand. That is a very powerful argument, because it really says what Russians are convinced of, as is the Kremlin and the people, and I am personally too, I fully agree with that, is that Russia's cornered and has no other option. Once that's clear in your mind, that this is not a do I turn left or right situation, that is, do I submit or fight?
Right.
And submission is not an option either, because submission really brings up, I mean, you know, look at the other countries who ended up being submitted. Libya, Syria, not Syria, still fighting, but Iraq, Afghanistan. You know, the Russians don't want to go there. Absolutely not.
Right.
And
right.
Secondly, there are the memories of World War II. A lot of them say, my God, when we see that hatred for us, the last time there was such Russophobia, we ended up with, you know, Barbarossa and German tanks running over us. So we will fight. And at that point, you know, economic sanctions don't make much of a difference. I'm pretty convinced that if the people of the United States were actually threatened in their livelihood and their security, and their options was to submit or to fight, they would fight just as much as the Russians would if they had the same degree of conviction that they have no other option.
Right. Although here, remember, Americans have no faith in their leadership.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Whether the Russians do have a rock solid faith in Putin, but then I would say, but why do they trust him that so much? Because really, his willingness to openly say that. For instance, there was a very famous situation a couple of years ago, I think it was in St. Petersburg, where a journalist told Putin, you know, the West is trying to humiliate us. And Putin replied, no, you're getting that wrong. They're not trying to humiliate us. They just want us to submit. You know, and that kind of message, really, you know, it's people receive that, and it's a shock for them.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and pro-Western liberals right now in Russia must be most definitely under 5%, I would say 1% to 3%. When they start saying, look at that confrontation, was it worth it? Look, we have now sanctions, etc. The typical argument of the rest, which is, you know, over 80% of people, is first of all, it's not the sanctions that hurt us. It's the really the fall in the prices of oil primarily. Secondly, sanctions were imposed long before. The West was already anti-Russian by moving NATO to our borders during the very same years when we were submitting to every single demand from the West. And finally, you know, is having less French oysters or less French cheese in Moscow a reason not to fight for our sovereignty?
Right.
Because once Russians accept that they're at war, and I think they are, I call it an 80% informational war, 15% economic war, and 5%, you know, military war. Once you accept that, you realize that as the cost for wars come, right now Russia is having it cheap, particularly if you compare with the Ukraine. So that's why Russians are standing very steadfast, because they think a price to pay is inevitable, and they're convinced that they're paying the cheaper price by being steadfast.
They are.
I think they are. I agree.
I agree with them completely. Now, there is a very wide disparity in the, you know, if you read the sort of U.S.-friendly sources, basically what they say, the oil price is going to continue low, and there's no way the Russian economy can survive, and ultimately Putin will fall.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't buy that at all.
Right, and you don't buy that at all. So what I would love for you to talk a little bit about is the oil price, the economy, and what you see is lying ahead for Russia.
Well, first of all, the oil price is remaining low. First of all, that's an assumption that needs to be questioned for how long it will remain low. As long as there's a generalized crisis worldwide, yes, probably. But that means it's a problem for everybody. Maybe for the West, it's a problem in terms of having an economic crisis. For the Russian, it's the effect of that crisis, which is a problem. But really, and most Russians agree to that, the problem of Russia is an economy that needs to be diversified, that needs to do other things. And it has other resources. Russia has fantastic human resources in technology, nuclear technology, civilian nuclear technology, aerospace, you know, computers, science, chemical engineering, you name it. Also resources, other resources than oil, water, simple water. This is going to be very expensive pretty soon. Russia has plenty of it. So I don't believe that Russia, you know, the Russian, I think it's McCain who said that Russia is just a large gas station. That's an oversimplification. It was that for years, because particularly during the Yeltsin years, where everything was being sacrificed, and all the legacy of the Soviet Union, which left a huge technological and economic legacy, everything was squandered and destroyed for the quick fix of selling oil. That's true. But that also brought the crisis about. So Russians don't want to go that way anymore. And they're counting on their human potential, particularly, to come out of it. And the last projections I saw is that there are, I think, renowned economists who predict that already next year, Russia will get out of the recession, albeit at very small figures, but, you know, marginally come out, which is not bad at all compared to the situation, you know, in Europe or in other countries. So there's a global crisis, which is bad for Russia anyways. It's compounded by, it triggers low oil prices, which is bad for Russia, of course. And then there are sanctions which present short to mid-term problems to Russia, particularly in credit. But none of these are fully, you know, necessarily crucial, and there is right now a fight between several economists in Russia, specifically to name them. On one hand, there's Kudrin, the former minister and Sergei Glazyev, an advisor, who are now members of the same board of economic advisors to Putin. He put them all together in one board, and they had very recently a meeting which rumor has it, there was behind closed doors, but rumor has it that the two clashed pretty strongly on the options, and basically Putin's decision was, we shall not sacrifice sovereignty on economic rationale. However, we will undertake further needed economic reforms. So I think in a way it's a blessing for Russia, that situation.
Right. 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 Well, I was going to say the sanctions have done a lot to help the internal agriculture build up its capacity.
Yes.
So, which ultimately I think would really help Russia be more sovereign. And of course, we haven't brought up the values, because one of the things that's going on here is, I'm going to grossly oversimplify. We have the Orthodox Church up against, what do I call Washington nihilism?
Yes.
So there's
that's as good as anything. Yes.
So there's a deep values issue, and it translates into the economic of, are we an economy that organizes around people, or are we an economy that organizes around harvesting people for big corporations? Is that fair to say?
I think that's happening in Russia, yes. But I would say that most of the economic circles in Russia are also, turbo capitalists. I mean, mm-hmm. There are exceptions. Some of them are very well known. But that's one reason why a lot of people, there's a good segment of the population of Moscow that hates Putin. That's where you will find the most pro-Western peoples, the people who think that capitalism will allow them to get rich. What protects Putin is that the majority of people have a say, and by their votes they get to resist that pressure. So conceptually, the way I see it is that there's a struggle for sovereignty in almost every country, I would say, between big money and the people. And as long as as long as people retain the sovereignty, big money has to serve them, essentially. But when big money becomes the ruler, it's not one person, one vote, it's $1, one vote, like in the United States, then the people become an expendable commodity. That struggle is still happening in Russia now. I wouldn't say it's that clear. There is a lot, it's particularly that orthodoxy is part of it, or I would say traditional Islam, but a lot of people are still looking. You hear very often Russians saying Russia needs a new national idea. It's there. I mean, it's social as opposed to socialism. They say Russia is a social state. It is fairness, and fairness is a big part of that. Morality, I think Russia stands for also, most people do support traditional families, respect for traditional values. So it's there. But again, it's brewing. It hasn't reached as strong a consensus as, for instance, the defense of Russia against the empire, which is now has totally solidified in a social context. What you're mentioning, these values things, are being hotly debated, and I would say it's in a brewing stage. It's not finalized yet.
Right. So let's talk about war, because from where I sit, and I'm not watching this anywhere nearly as closely as you are, let alone have the depth of your knowledge, but it hasn't looked to me like it was getting close to war. And so I'm curious as to why you think Russia knows the dangers of war, and Putin's been a very masterful bureaucrat about sort of walking up to the line and then backing away and protecting his turf without getting tricked into anything that I would describe as stupid, let alone a nuclear war. So what is it that has inspired this warning, and why do you think we're in danger of going to a new level of crisis?
Okay, well, first it was a general principle. It takes two for peace, it takes one for war. That's really crucial to see. Secondly, when you say, it doesn't look like we are close or came close, let me ask you this. What would have happened if Russians would have retaliated for the way the Turks shut down the Russian Sukhoi 24 over Syria? I mean, the Russian options would have been anything between shooting down the plane that did it. Now, as far as I know, that plane was protected by American F-15C. So it would have been an air combat, or a much simpler option for the Russians would have been to send a cruise missile on the airbase from which that airplane took off. So let's say Russia would have retaliated against the Turks, which certainly would not have backed down. Imagine a shooting war starting between Russia and Turkey. Are you confident that NATO would have said to the Turks, you guys started, you're on your own? I am not. I think that's what they probably would have done. I want to believe that they would have done it. As far as I know, everybody, you know, common sense prevailed. First of all, Putin did not order retaliation. And interestingly, instead of calling Putin to apologize or even to explain himself, the Turkish president immediately went to Brussels and said, you know, I just poked the big guy, help me. And NATO sent, as far as I know, NATO sent him the signal, you know, you're on your own. You started that shit. We don't want to get involved. So,
right.
I
can't believe the Turks would have done that without the U.S.
Yes,
you know,
but that's like the war in Georgia. The U.S. is not a single actor. We all know that the CIA disagrees with State Department. The State Department disagrees with the Pentagon. You know, they all have their different agenda. They even, you know, there's a situation in the U.S. where Americans are bombing units where, you know, the U.S. Special Forces are right there next to them. So it's kind of a crazy situation. I want to believe that this will happen in the future again, that, you know, when push comes to shove, military people say, we don't want any part of that. And on both ends, I'm happy that, you know, the Georgian situation was resolved without a war, the Turkish situation was resolved without a war. But are you confident that the next time around, imagine this, the Latvians do something truly stupid, I don't know, something idiotic, just to make themselves relevant on the map again, like attacking a Russian vessel, Navy vessel.
Right.
Russians shoot back. Then what? You know, this is how it could start. It could start very low and dumb, end up very dramatic. Secondly, the neocons. I mean, would you put it past them to actually deliberately start a war? I wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't.
I think we should take the rhetoric very seriously.
Right.
So these are the two things that worry me. You know, an escalation that nobody wanted, really, or, you know, a crackpot being in power.
And who would be more dangerous in terms of Clinton or Trump? Who's going to give more power to the neocons?
Well, I'm limited in my ability to answer this one. I would say I cannot conceive of somebody worse than Clinton is the first part of my answer. I mean, to me, she's just something unreal in terms of she is the perfect marriage of evil and incompetence and arrogance. So she's scary.
Right.
Trump, for me, is an unknown card. I don't know. I read somewhere that somebody said about him he's 95% crazy and 5% patriotic, which puts him head and shoulders above everybody else. I don't know. I really don't know. I certainly anything but Clinton. I don't like that, you know, choose the lesser evil. But if in the next election, honestly, I would put my, if I had to decide, it's a horrible choice, but I would definitely go with Trump over Clinton. Because Clinton, I have no hope. Trump, I do have hope.
Right. It's really funny. I did an interview the other day, and I kept saying that Clinton is the no-hope choice.
Yes, it really is.
It's 100% no hope.
Yes, it's really getting the worst possible person, but worst by every single, you know, by every single criteria. I think she's incompetent. She's dishonest. She's evil. She's arrogant. She's detached from reality. She doesn't understand. Her statement about the war in Libya is just appalling. And I think she's trying to prove that she's the bigger guy on the block. She wants to show Putin that, you know, she's this, you know, she will show him. No, she won't. And that's what's really scary to me.
Well, if you look at Haiti, if you look at Libya, basically what you're talking about is going in and destroying a country. You know, you're talking about raping a place and taking whatever, you know, you go and you rape it. You take the gold, you take the minerals, you take the oil, you take the... you know, it's raping the landscape, and the remarkable thing about it is the Clintons are so good at the PR that says, oh, you know, we're helping women, we're helping.
Mm-hmm.
The PR is quite astonishing. You can't, you know, it almost makes you long for Cheney, who says, look, you know, they have it, we need it, we're going to take it. It's yes, like, oh, absolutely. Thank God, a man of integrity.
Yes. You know, I remember when the last Bush term was coming to an end, I was telling my wife, I can't imagine we'll ever regret this one. Well, after sitting with Obama, I frankly do regret them. Yeah, I really do. I think his group was actually, I mean, I get a stomachache every time I see or hear Clinton, Obama speak. And I'm afraid that if Hillary gets elected, I'm going to regret Obama.
Right.
Which is horrible. I mean, it's such a depressing statement to have to make.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because we've seen a process develop in the United States where you get leaders who speak very conceptually in a way that's divorced from reality on the ground. And if you watch Putin, it took me a long time to kind of get a beat on Putin. And finally I realized, oh, he's a bureaucrat. He is a brilliant, capable, astute bureaucrat who keeps returning to the facts on the ground and the rules and the law. And he's willing to deal with complexity and capable of dealing with complexity, which, of course, you know, when you deal with someone like Obama and Clinton who are just, you know, marketing fluffy into the cameras, talking concepts that don't relate to anything going on in the ground. You can see why you have these remarkable dialogues between them.
I would characterize as Putin. I don't like when people say he's a former KGB officer because they confuse the KGB with the Foreign Intelligence Service. But
right.
In this case, I would see he is a KGB officer in the sense that he has a higher degree in law and he was trained to understand complexity. But I would say if I had to say one word to characterize him, I wouldn't use the word bureaucrat. I would say officer. The guy is an officer, and he's a foreign intelligence officer, and that means that complexity is his natural environment.
Right. The reason I say bureaucrat is, and I mean that as a compliment, I used to work at HUD, and you'd get these, they were called SES, it was the senior service, and they were as smart and as capable line management as you would ever meet in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very astute about navigating hostile environments and surviving. And they knew how to use facts and the rules. And they kept coming because they were responsible to operationalize things.
Yes.
They kept coming back to reality in a way that would drive the politicians mad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because one is dealing with reality and the other is, you know, talking into the camera and playing a media game.
And, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
And that's definitely him. I would just add two qualities which your colleagues that might have not or not have, which is I think the man is a man of principle and of courage, personal courage.
Right. Now, why do, when you said there's groups of people in Russia who hate him, why do people hate Putin?
Well, because he took away, that's the old Russian disease. It's, you know, it's the ruler versus the elites. Russia has a weird tradition of having the czar fight the aristocrats.
Right.
By creating such a strong power of one person, and not by being a dictator, but by his personal charisma and popularity, he's depriving the former elites of a lot of their power.
Right.
He is a direct threat to those who wish they were, you know, oligarchs with not only money, but also with political power. What he did, he allowed them to keep most of their money, but the clear understanding was, don't you dare stick your nose in politics. That was sort of the balance. So the Russian oligarchy, the Russian, you know, those who did really well in Moscow, who now are suffering, proportionally suffering from the difficulties, are very mad at him. Because they have difficulties abroad, they don't get to have their second Porsche for the same deal, and they really think that all this patriotic stuff is they don't care about, you know, their country at all. Their logic would be, why do we need Crimea when it was in Ukrainian hands? I also went on holidays there. Or the other option, why do we need Crimea? I take my holidays in the Maldives. You know, or Thailand.
Well, so, the other thing is, you've got all the money on the planet, because this is true. You know, this is true the world over. You've got all the money in the planet working people like that, offering them all sorts of opportunities, commissions, wealth, a piece of the action. if they'll just play ball and arrange some kind of compromise of the Russian sovereignty for the benefit of this player and that player. So you've got all the money in the world singing the sweet song of, oh, come play with us and, you know, let's change the model in Russia.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Yeah, and a lot of those people aren't very good at withstanding that game. There are a couple other points I wanted to bring up.
Yep.
One is we just watch the first railroad line go from China all the way into Iran. I think cutting the days of transport relative to shipping by sea, 41 days. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening along the Silk Road is you're watching an investment in infrastructure that is absolutely tying Europe to Asia and Asia to Europe, Russia, of course, sitting right in the middle of that. And the economics of that, I think, is part of the reason that the U.S. keeps trying to tie Europe back into the United States and make trouble on the Silk Road.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so maybe talk a little bit about that and the tightening up of these two big markets, what that has to do with what's happening.
Well, that's a big component of that, of course. The idea was, you know, the zone was, you know, from the Atlantic to the Urals, or actually from Lisbon to Vladivostok, which is the bigger version of that. The idea would be, of course, to create a very prosperous landmass. And right now, there was a conference a couple of days ago of the leaders of the Economic Union, were again trying to discuss how can we offer, you know, a deal, a trade common space to the European Union as a whole. Because,
right.
Of course, naturally, I mean, everybody would benefit from that. The EU would have access to Asia. Russia would play the role of a super Ukraine between, if you want, a space between Far East Asia and Europe. Everybody would profit that, but who would be excluded? I mean, it's pretty obvious. It's the United States. So the United States are desperate to cut China out of the Pacific Rim region and to cut Russia away from Europe, because they realize that inherently, you use the expression that you said that the dollar is backed by space weapons. I like to say that it's backed by aircraft carrier battle groups, but it's the same concept. I mean, right now the dollar has only firepower to make it, you know, attractive in quotation marks. But when Russia and China are involved, that is just not real, because neither China nor Russia, the U.S. cannot afford a war with China or Russia. So the only option left is to create a crisis to try to prevent, as Hillary said it very clearly in one of her speeches when she was just resigned from being Secretary of State, she said, we're going to do everything we can to prevent a second Soviet Union. Well, that included an economic integrated space.
Right.
So that's a fundamental, crucial national strategic priority for the 1%ers in the U.S., not to allow the mainland, you know, the big mass, the Eurasian mass, to integrate and to begin prospering.
Right, and flourish.
Yeah.
One thing I want to mention, Bayer just made an offer for Monsanto that Monsanto turned down, but there's no doubt that there's blood in the water on Monsanto. We have a number of big U.S. multinationals conceding that they're going to walk away from GMO or GMO labeling, and the whole GMO push, it appears, is failing now. They're always consolidating and coming back again. But it's fair to say that the consumer rejection is unbelievably powerful and strong, and just demand for fresh and organic and non-GMO is the growth rates are compelling. It's one of the few things in the economy that's really growing. And I really do think that Putin very cleverly fed into this, because when he announced, you know, when the sanctions were going on, no GMOs in Russia, it's outlawed. I think that gave a lot of sort of political support in an informal way to activists all over the world who are trying to stop GMO.
Yes, but I don't believe it was part of the counter sanctions. That was a general strategic decision to outlaw GMOs in Russia, and even considering the import of them as a form of terrorism, actually. So it's very strictly regulated now. Yeah, because Russia
Now explain what that means. So
that means that you end up 20 years of hard labor if you try to bring in GMOs and you know,
really
growing them. Yeah,
20 years of hard labor.
You could get 20 years of hard labor. Yes, you could. That's, in theory, what you're risking. Yeah, they consider that as a form of terrorism because it threatens Russian national security and the food supply, which they consider a national asset. So they're very dead set against it. And secondly, let's be cynical about it. It's not only because they're such wonderful green feelings, but they realize that they have a huge export potential of essentially, organic food.
Right,
corn,
exactly.
As much as you want, water, wheat, I mean, you name it, Russians have it in huge amounts because all of their food is essentially, non-GMO.
Right. Okay, global slowdown. We're seeing signs all over the world that the economy is slowing for many reasons. And the reality is the more global everything seems to slow down, the more push there is for military this, military that. One of the few sectors in the stock market that's doing well are the defense contractors. Is part of your call for warning about war concern that global slowdown is going to inspire leaders to turn to war to distract their populations?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. When a government is illegitimate, when an economy is in crisis, an external war is always a very useful thing for a politician. Unfortunately,
right.
Yes.
Right. One of the things I talked a lot about last year in the annual wrap-up, and I keep talking about, is the fact that without any announcement or democratic decision, essentially the Treaty of Westphalia has been torn up, and sovereign governments in many places no longer have a monopoly on force within that jurisdiction, and we're seeing all sorts of supranational players who basically have their own private armies and are using physical force to get their way. At war start, starting wars is great business for them. So it's you're seeing more and more of the military infrastructure turn private and basically marketing their capacity by starting conflicts. And my impression is that within Russia, force is still the monopoly of the state, that this kind of behavior is not going on as much inside of Russia the way it is, for example, in the Middle East. But does that growth of all these private players, do you think that fits into this?
I think it's probably above them. I would agree, first of all, with you that in Russia there is a monopoly of force. Absolutely. It's actually being centralized. I mentioned the recent creation of the National Guard, which will put a number of agencies under one command. And the Ministry of Internal Affairs is also streamlined and rationalized. So there is that. There was a little bit of a question with Ramzan Kadyrov being a little bit too independent in the Ukraine. But since his units are now basically part of the National Guard, the problem is solved. So, yes, in Russia, there is a monopoly of force. But are these private actors triggering these conflicts? Frankly, I think it's probably above them. In a sense, even bigger interest. I would go for big finance and banking. Those are those who have the most interest in creating these wars and tensions. Now, do the private providers of violence benefit? Yes, immensely. Of course, that's their turf.
Right. Every week we have a let's go to the movies because I like to use movies to kind of describe different phenomena of what's happening. And this week we're gonna have 13 Hours, which is the movie that was made trying to describe what went on in Benghazi.
Yeah, I just saw it yesterday.
Oh, really? Oh, fabulous. Perfect. So one theory as to what in the world was going on is that Stevens and the group the CIA group there in Benghazi were basically rounding up the weapons that they found in Libya and transferring them over to the anti-Assad group in Syria. Do you think there's any merit to that theory?
Already at that time? I don't know. I don't know.
Right.
It seems to me awfully planned. I mean, most of my impression is that most of these covert operations are usually more short-term and then almost sometimes knee-jerk, possibly. I mean, what is certain is that after Gaddafi fell, as he predicted, the weapons and the jihadis start flowing into Syria. How much of a role did the CIA play with that? I think at a certain moment it definitely got involved very heavily and assisted, just as it did during the war in Bosnia. But was it at the moment right now in Benghazi when the ambassador was killed? Were they doing just that? Maybe. I really wouldn't know.
So do you have a theory on what in the world happened or why the United States, one, did not provide proper security or was not willing to intercede and protect?
Well, unless I have proof otherwise, I usually like to go and assume incompetence and poor planning, poor understanding, lack of specialists. I'm not going to go into some theory saying that it was triggered deliberately or any of that. No, I think it's probably just incompetence and lack of understanding of the local culture on so many levels that you don't go just into a country as complex as Libya was, come with a bunch of weapons and then think that things will be simple. I think that's the main case. I mean, frankly, I think a lot of things of that kind of can be explained by simple stupidity.
Right. Well, I think that can be explained by stupidity. I guess that the question is why the United States let him hang for a whole 24 hours. That's
what were their options, really? I mean, they would have to. I think the movie shows that there was a turf war. First of all, who's in charge of doing what? And then when you send somebody in to rescue, you have a chance of being then having to rescue the rescuers. That is true. The military is very averse to that kind of open-ended, go and fix it kind of stuff. I mean, and that's actually logical. There comes a point where you don't send in rescues because you don't want to have more. That actually makes sense to me. The real question for me is how did they ever get there? And how did they so misread the local environment? Because there's normally what's called an intelligence preparation of the battlefield, where you should have a pretty good understanding of what's happening. And if the movie is anywhere near correct, there seems to be complete miscommunication and turf war at every single level over and over again. And competing turf is actually one of the big ways that the United States has tradition of. If you look at the invasion of Grenada, that's another one of those that, you end up with a cluster bleep mainly due to, turf wars and bureaucratic infighting. And I very much recognize the same kind of pattern in what seems to have happened in Benghazi.
Right. Well, one of the things I've observed from Washington from afar is we've had 20 or 30 years of people being promoted who were good at kissing you know what as opposed to competency. And you, when corruption takes over, you get this incredible debasement within the bureaucracy. The military has been more protected, but you start running, for example, the military around who generates, purchases and sales for defense contractors and various bureaucracies over who makes money for corporations. So, mm-hmm. So you have all these political considerations, related to harvesting, the federal budget and the federal credit that have nothing to do with fundamental competency.
Absolutely.
And so, so you lose your ability to really, create an operational capacity. One of the things that frightens me is if you look at what Clinton was doing with the email server and then what the foundation was doing, sort of racketeering, dovetailing with what she was doing on the private server and at the State Department, the message to all the people who have to operationalize foreign policy, whether it's in the military, whether it's in the intelligence agencies, whether it's in the line agencies, is, who is coming in is a group of people, both cabinet level and sub-cabinet level, who feel free to just racketeer, and and their business is harvesting the situation. And meantime, they expect you to go off and tee up all the situations they're going to harvest. Well, it's putting you at incredible danger.
Yes, absolutely.
So why in the world would you perform? You wouldn't.
No, absolutely. And to make a parallel with Libya, I strongly suspect that until Gaddafi was overthrown, you had a lot of business people cruising around their country, but probably they had very poor intelligence. And once they came in, how many language specialists did they have? How many locals could they really trust? What was the quality of their information? And what part of that was, presented to the politicals to paint a rosy picture?
Right.
You're detached with reality, or as you say, if you can't cope with complexity, as soon as you end up with a complex situation, it's bound to blow up in your face, and that's what happened.
I hate to say it, it's what Putin said about negotiating with Obama. He said it's like negotiating with a pigeon. He walks into the board, knocks the players over, shits, and then leaves and says he won.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I can't disagree with that. That's exactly the problem. And that's why I'm afraid of a war in Europe. Because it's a complex situation. That's getting dangerous, too. And
yeah,
a lot of bad actors
dangerous.
Are providing very bad advice. For instance, all the East European governments were, making themselves relevant by also engaging in that ridiculous notion that they're about to be invaded by Russia, are really not helping the situation one bit.
The this morning's poll in The Guardian indicates that that Brexit is now in the lead. So if the vote was taken today, if the poll's correct, Britain will leave the European Union. Now, that's far from over, because we're not at the vote yet. But if Britain pulls out, then you're going to talk about more acceleration of some of these trends.
Yes.
I think, yeah.
And the worse the situation gets, I still believe that the Mediterranean countries, that is Spain, France very, very much, Italy very much, have a potential of revolting, and Greece, of course. But particularly
right.
Italy and France, the social tensions are huge. And I would not, exclude the possibility of some kind of big political event making a change of power, resulting in a change of power, and then France starting to pull out of NATO and or the EU, because they're suffering tremendously from the crazy situation. And they're aware
of it. Here's the thing. If both in the EU and the United States, you have in leadership positions a group of people who've been have been centralizing political and economic power. And the problem is that centralization has been very destructive to the economy in many different ways, not just in the EU, but the US, but globally. Now, they've managed to centralize a great deal of power. And you can argue, if you're in the U.S. and the EU and you're looking at the rise of Asia, you're thinking, okay, well, we want to have much more centralized clout so we can go compete with those guys because they're so huge. So maybe you can argue it that way. But at some point, it seems to me, we could fund the centralization of power by issuing more government debt. So you centralize power, it hurts the economy. So you turn around and you issue more debt and give people government checks, and you cover over the externalities of destroying the marketplace by pumping it up with debt. Now the debt growth model is over. And so what I'm seeing globally is a whole world of leaders who are going to be forced to get back to fundamental productivity. And how do you keep the centralization going? You can't. If you look at the plans to further centralize here in the United States, education, government, healthcare, basically what you're going to talk, what you're talking about doing is now doing something which is so unnatural and so destructive of local economies that you're going to get a revolt of some kind, or you're going to destroy the economy.
Let me ask you this. Do you believe that the people who made it all happen, there's an entire quote-unquote elite, a ruling class, that build its career, academic credentials, everything, they build that. Do you think they're capable of reforming themselves and changing course? Or do we have to get rid of them before any of that happens?
I'm not quite sure, because I think if you look at the, if you look at the 20% who implement policy, they're looking around at this point, and you've got a lot of very intelligent people in that group. And they're looking around at the destruction of the fundamental economy coming from out of the centralization. And I think they're beginning to see things that where they realize, one, we could get re-engineered out by the robots. But two, this is sufficiently inhuman that we're worried about the health and well-being of our own families.
Really? You think it could get that far? The 20% would actually think like that, even if they get their extra little yacht and maybe their end of year, premium and maybe a career promotion if they just play ball.
You know, I'm seeing an ambivalence in some of them. Now, I don't know what percentage that is, but I'm seeing, here's the thing, and it goes back to sort of what's happening between Russia and the United States. I told you the story of having lunch. I was sitting with my lawyers in a Washington restaurant, and something happened with respect to my litigation in the conversation about what was going on in Washington. And a chill went down my back, Saker, and I realized this thing is so perverted. It's so nuts. I want nothing to do with it. I'm walking out. I'm walking out of the establishment, and I'm going out in the wilderness, and whatever, you know, even if I die in the wilderness, that is preferable to being part of this, because this is so sick and perverted. I want nothing to do with it. And ultimately, I know it can't win, because anything that has within it the seeds of a demonic economy, it can liquidate economies, but ultimately, it's like a tapeworm. It eats its host.
Well, all I can say is I hope and pray that there are more people like you who think that way. I mean, yes, it can happen that a system gets so morally discredited that nobody wants to stand up for it and everybody wants out. I mean, it's actually what happened in the Soviet Union in large part. I hope that that's true. I want to believe that that's true. I mean, that's really the purpose of my blog.
Well, I don't know that that's true, but I'll tell you the number one problem in the economy right now is liquidity doesn't come from money. It comes from trust. It doesn't come from force. It comes from trust. Now, you can force a lot, and you can throw money at it with government debt. But when the government debt game runs out, you know, you've got to have trust, and the trust is breaking down. That's what is, really hurting the economy. And it's interesting. I just bought and I've been reading the book by the former governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King. Mm-hmm. And in his second chapter, he's talking about the breakdown of trust and how trust makes the economy go round, not money. And I did not expect to hear this from, you know, one of the guys who helped engineer the bailouts, although clearly he was opposed to it at the beginning.
Well, so, do you think I'm cynical or ignorant if I say that my impression is that what makes money go around is corruption?
No, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I disagree with that. If you look at a publicly traded stock, a company makes, let's say a company has stock and it's making $1 earnings per share a year, and its stock is trading at a multiple of 20 times earnings, and therefore it's worth $20. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, if I'm running a narcotics trafficking business, I have a much higher margin than that company has. Let's say it makes batteries. Mm-hmm. So let's say it has a 10% margin. I'm running narcotics. I have a 30 or 40% margin, you know, plus I don't have to pay taxes. I have to pay a lot of bribes, but I don't have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. So I've got much higher margins, but I can't translate that higher margin into a 20 times multiple. You know, my multiple is 1 times. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the system that it takes to put in place a way of creating that engine that has that kind of capital gains, you've got to have the widespread market believing that they can put money in a brokerage account and they can trust the system. Okay. So that kind of leverage depends on enormous amounts of trust in the system by a wide variety of players. And one of the problems you have is for the last 20 years, the Anglo-American Alliance has been stretching that trust and breaking it down.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason people keep getting afraid about the financial system is they're worried that that trust could go, and it could. So, no, financial liquidity depends on extraordinary. I mean, on Wall Street, we would sit and, you know, you would have syndicates of people making hundreds of billions of dollars of commitments all verbally, and they kept those you know, they kept those commitments because if not, you were, you know, you were out forever if you didn't keep your word.
Mm-hmm.
So I think trust is very important, very important.
And do you think there's more distrust towards Anglo-American banking or finance out there than to the rest of the world? I mean, isn't all of banking and finance pretty much linked to one transnational entity? Or would you say there's a separate, more gradually less reputable Anglo-American finance and banking system?
So here's the question. At the top, it's a mystery, okay? And yes, there's an Anglo-American system which has had enormous amounts of liquidity and leverage, and the others have not begun to build the networks and the systems they need. And that's what we're watching the Chinese and Russians and BRICS start to do now. And that's why the American, the Anglo-American alliance is feeling so insecure, because the others are starting to come together and build the relationships and the practical coalitions and different systems you need to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's one of the most interesting phenomena is what is going on there. But then the question still remains, who's at the top? Because if you look at what's happening on this planet economically, the number one problem is it's being harvested. And the question is, where in the hell is the money going? And who's really in charge? Mm-hmm. And that's still a mystery. I don't know. And I've spent my life trying to figure it out. Who's doing this?
I feel better about not knowing it either, then.
Well, we're figuring it out. We're chipping away
yeah,
at it.
Trying.
It's really funny. There's a science fiction movie called Jupiter Ascending. I don't know if you've seen it, but at one point, a woman who's the sister of the man who's supposedly owns Earth turns to the protagonist, who's a woman from America, and says, "You know, my dear, Earth is just a very small part of a much bigger corporation."
yeah, I saw that. Yes, it is.
Right.
It's pretty good.
It's a perfect scene. I said, oh, that's where the money's going. Anyway, okay, well, Saker, you've been very generous with your time. Before we go, just say one last thing. If you're listening to this and you want to make sure war doesn't happen, what do you do? How can we contribute to prayers for peace in a practical way?
In a practical way, first of all, by raising the alarm about the prospects of war and explaining to particularly people in the United States that this time it will not be limited to Europe. Secondly,
right.
By never voting or supporting or donating to any politician who contributes to creating that problem. Never go against your conscience. Live only by the truth. And I would say, thirdly, take action yourself and start writing, protesting, speaking, and trying to convince people that a war does not need to happen. There is no objective reason for that whatsoever.
Right. In your article, which I will republish at Soleri, you made a very good point about this popular notion that war is that Americans are used to getting the benefits of war in many respects and not the paying the price. Although I'm from the southern United States and we've lost a lot of wonderful young people to war. So we're a little
Absolutely.
Bit more sensitive.
Yeah. But it's kept hidden from the general public. Yeah, everybody knows a veteran who has been wounded or killed by now. I know.
Right.
It's hidden. And the cost will be way higher.
Much. Yep. Okay, well, you're the best. Thank you, and we look forward to the next quarter. Be thinking about what we're going to talk about.
I return you the compliment, and thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.